This is the fifth day of this June 2012 six-day sesshin. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of the 10th and 11th, or 11th and 12th century Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu from a book called Zen Letters, translated by J.C. and Thomas Cleary. And here's this book is a collection of letters, and here's a new one. Right now, if students are in fact truly genuine, source teachers can contact their potential and activate it with a single word or phrase or a single act or scene. What could be difficult about that? If students are in fact truly genuine, it's an interesting choice of words as a translation. Really, what it means is if students are the mind of the student is in a condition of purity, of no mindedness, no thought, samadhi, which means a state where the meditator and the object meditated upon are fused. There's no not two. Samadhi is a precondition for awakening. And that genuine is not a bad word if you consider that in such a state, as anyone knows who's been in such a state, we feel authentic or genuine to our bones, inside and out. Because there's no split. We're whole, fully integrated, no divisions, nothing lacking, nothing in excess, utterly simple, clean, genuine. When a student is in that state, then a teacher can nudge the student sometimes into awakening, he goes on. The only problem is when your faculties are unstable and your consciousness shallow, whirled around and around like the wind in the treetops. True reality is shown to you thousands and thousands of times, but you still cannot mesh with it. True reality is shown to you. Well, we could go further and say that true reality is us. It's not something out there that we have to be shown. We are it, this true reality. It's our nature. Therefore, in learning the way, what is most valuable is being true and sincere. Sincere is another helpful way of understanding the state of complete integration, purity, because we could say that as long as we are divided, our mind in one place and our body somewhere else, we're doing something and our mind is somewhere else, then what we're doing, we could kind of say that it's insincere. It's not with our whole being. Another letter. People who study the way, I hate this word study, people who practice the way begin by having the faith to turn toward it. Well, in simple nuts and bolts terms, that means turning toward the practice we're working on. And when we're moving about, doing things, talking with people, turning toward it means just being fully engaged, present in what we're doing. They are fed up with the vexations and filth of the world and are always afraid they will not be able to find a road of entry into the way. I think for many of us, what brings us to practice is we're just fed up with ourselves. We're fed up with the way we lead our lives, the way we move through our activities. Roshi Kaplow, in looking back to his own life before practice, quoted, can't remember who, maybe D.H. Lawrence, in referring to this as the joyless pursuit of pleasure. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation in this joyous pursuit of pleasure. Some people catch on sooner than others. Some people get saturated with that. They see the futility of it. They see the dead end of it sooner than others. Some people have to spend years and years, and sometimes years and years more, cycling through that kind of joyless pursuit for getting their fill of it. Once you have been directed by a teacher or else discovered on your own the originally inherently complete real mind, then no matter what situations or circumstances you encounter, you know for yourself where it's really at. Roshi Kaplow used to say that in Zen, the realized Zen person knows where she stands and knows where others stand. There is a seeing, a knowing, a certainty. But then if you hold fast to that real mind, the problem is you cannot get out and it becomes a nest. What does he mean, hold fast to that real mind? Well, really it means to the idea of it. Clinging to the idea of reality or truth. Then it becomes another attachment, another trap, a nest, he says. You set up illumination and function in acts and states, snort and clap and glare and raise your eyebrows, deliberately putting on a scene. These are the kind of things that people without a really true understanding of Zen do, because they think it's what Zen people are supposed to do, realize Zen people are supposed to do these things. These are affectations. When you meet a genuine expert of the school again, he removes all this knowledge and understanding for you so you can merge directly with realization of the original, uncontrived, unpreoccupied, unminding state. After this, you will feel shame and repentance and know to cease and desist. You will proceed to vanish utterly, so that not even the sages can find you arising anywhere, much less anyone else. Here's a warning about the kind of Zen, what we call Zen stink, that follows an awakening experience. We have to pass through that and shake off that stink and become utterly, genuine, uncontrived, unaffected, empty, transparent. It's a saying in Zen, nothing distinguishes the enlightened person. Complete naturalness. Linchi or Rinzai once said, virtuous monks just be ordinary. Don't put on airs. We live in a society where there are so many forces conspiring to push us into trying to assert our individuality, our specialness. Just be ordinary. Be authentic. It's the most any of us can be. And then he quotes Yantao or Ganto. Those people who actually realize it just keep serene and free at all times, without cravings, without dependence. And then Yuan Wu says, isn't this the door to peace and happiness? Without cravings, without wanting something more all the time. Zen Master Dogen spoke of being able to look at flowers without demanding more color, or to look at the moon without asking it to have more brightness. Things as they are. Another letter. The ancients worked hard for the sake of the one great cause. He likes this. The Cleary boys like this phrase, the one great cause. You can say it's another way of expressing mind. Again, referring to the ancients, their determination is indeed worthy of respect, and they served as an everlasting example for later generations. Determination, such a huge asset in spiritual practice. Not being deflected from this path, not being discouraged, but determined. When you set your body on the meditation bench, this is, I have circled here, bench. It was really interesting. On one of my pilgrimages, one of the two to China, we sat with the monks at Bodhidharma's temple, Shaolin Temple. And this was a morning sitting, and to our bafflement, instead of mats or even benches, as it says here, there were these concave wicker stool-like things. I think they carry them at Pier 1. I think I've seen them there. But concave. And maybe there was a mat, you know, sort of sunk there in this wicker or rattan thing. But we were just left scratching our heads. What kind of a sitting arrangement that is. But here now, meditation bench. Of course, we have benches. Some people use benches here, but something tells me it's not that. Anyway, let's make it a mat. When you set your body on the meditation mat, it is no more than silencing and emptying the mind and investigating with your whole being. Just make your mind and thoughts clarify and become still. A fine place to do active meditation work is amid confusion and disturbances. This is not what a lot of people would think of as a fine place to do meditation work, amid confusion and disturbances. What would be good about that? Well, one thing is that it would ensure that we're not attached to certain special conditions, like silence, stillness. There's a saying in Zen, the true sage is the sage, not the sage of the forest, but the sage of the marketplace. A mature meditation practice is one that does not require certain conditions such as silence, but can extend into the hurly-burly of daily life. As long as we avoid noise and confusion, then we won't discover that we can find stillness within noise and confusion. Some of you have heard me tell the story of, late 70s maybe. There was a little campaign organized by another Zen center, the Minnesota Zen Center, Minneapolis Zen Center. It was a time when there were protests about installing cruise missiles in Europe. And this fellow wanted to not just protest in favor of peace, protest against the installation of these cruise missiles, but to actually be peace, to demonstrate it. And so he organized a several day, 3 or 4 day meditation for peace thing right across from the United Nations. I mean, right across. There's a seven-lane avenue that runs along the United Nations building, and across that street from the United Nations, there's a little park, very little park, where it has a sculpture of a sword turned into a plowshare. And we sat there. There were some, you know, depending on the time, there were as few as 10, but as many as maybe 40 people during that that week. And we sat in Zazen, the way we all are here now, in silence. And we could hear in the distance the tumult of protesters. And then right alongside us in that seven-lane avenue, we happened to be sitting right there was a traffic light or a string of traffic lights. So the traffic all day long would come to a stop, and the idling cars, and then you hear got to hear the little click of the, and then exhaust and the noise. And at one time there were some fanatics who were coming and screaming at us, who wanted the cruise missiles installed, and you had no choice but to just dive deep into one's practice, into this, to find this silence in the midst of this. Or as the poet Shelley said, to find this smooth spot of glassy quiet amidst the battling tides. It was really an illuminating experience to find that even in those conditions we could lose ourselves in the silence of our own mind. When you do active meditation, you must penetrate through the heights and the depths without omitting anything. The whole essential being appears ready-made before you, and it no longer arises from anywhere else. It is just this one great potential, turning smoothly and steadily. Why talk any more about worldly phenomena and enlightened truth? If you maintain a uniform equilibrium over months and years, naturally your stand will be true and solid. This impulse, this tendency to want to retire into sweet silence, is one that meditators probably have always had. Naturally, of course, we don't want disturbance. We want to be in silence. It's the most natural thing in the world. But you read different warnings from the masters of old about this dependency. That's what it is. It's a dependency. One Chinese master, Yung Chi, said, "He who clings to vacancy, neglecting the world of things, escapes drowning but leaps into the fire." He goes on, "You will experience realization like water being poured into water, like gold being traded for gold. everything will be equalized in one suchness, profoundly clear, real, and pure. This is knowing how to live. Knowing how to live. I think many people have had this awareness, this insight in Sesshin of, I'm not talking about awakening, but usually it's late in Sesshin where one feels, this is how to live. This is how to be. When the mind settles, things become so effortless, so simple. There's a wonderful poem by Rainer Maria Rilke that seems to capture this sense of late Sesshin, everything settling and clarifying. It's called The Swan. This clumsy living that moves lumbering as if in ropes through what is not done, reminds us of the awkward way the swan walks, and to die, which is the letting go of the ground we stand on and cling to every day, is like the swan when he nervously lets himself down into the water, which receives him gaily, and which flows under and after him wave after wave, while the swan, unmoving and marvelously calm, is pleased to be carried each moment, more fully grown, more like a king, farther and farther on. Just have to let ourselves down into the water of mind. Sink into this mind, into the practice. Trust it. Surrender to it. Let go. Stop trying to be anything. Stop trying to do anything. Merge with this mind practice, mind being. Here's another letter. This one suggests the temperament of the recipient of the letter. I have seen many people who are intellectually brilliant, but whose faculties are unstable and whose practice is shallow. They think they witness transformation in verbal statements, and they assume that there is no way to go beyond the worldly. Thus they increase the thorns of arbitrary opinion as they show off their ability and understanding. They take advantage of their verbal agility and think that the Buddha Dharma is like this. When situations are born from causal conditions, they cannot pass through to freedom, So they wind up vacillating back and forth. This is really a great pity. So, yes, of course, we know people who love words, and usually these are people who are good with words, and they love to think of themselves as having insights through words, and yeah, they're certainly that can happen, little insights. But it is never to be confused with the real thing. This is why the ancients went through all sorts of experiences and faced all sorts of demons and difficulties. They took charge of their minds all the way along and made them as strong as iron or stone. Thus, when it came to passing through birth and death, they didn't waste any effort. Isn't this the special strength and generosity beyond emotionalism that truly great people possess? Generosity beyond emotionalism. I would take that to mean generosity without any attachment of a thought of one's generosity. It's quite a remarkable quality to give without pride. This reference to demons is just kind of an ancient way of referring to any of the obstacles that come up, physical or mental. When bodhisattvas who live a householder's life cultivate the practice of home leavers, it is like a lotus blooming in fire. Let me just pause and say this is probably could apply to most of us who live a householder's life, but they're cultivating the practices of home leavers. Well, starting with meditation. It will always be hard to tame the desire for fame and rank and power and position, not to mention all the myriad starting points of vexation and turmoil associated with the burning house of worldly existence. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental, real, wondrous wholeness and reach the stage of great calm and stability and rest. Remember, he's still talking to an actual person, a parishioner or a student. It would be best if you managed to cut off everything and be empty and ordinary. Thoroughly experience the absence of conditioned mind and observe that all phenomena are like dreams and magical illusions. Be empty all the way through. And continue on, clearing out your mind according to the time and the situation. Then you will have the same correct foundation as all the great enlightened laymen in Buddhist tradition. Be empty all the way through and continue on clearing out your mind. Well, we all know how to do that in our daily lives. It means noticing, first of all, noticing when our mind is somewhere else, when we're caught in thoughts, and dropping them. Dropping them, if we're working on a koan, go back to the koan, which is a dropping. That's how we drop thoughts when we're working on a koan. We just go to the koan. According to your own measure of power, you will transform those not yet enlightened so you can enter together into the uncontrived, uncluttered ocean of true nature. Then your life here on this earth will not be at a loss. next letter. The essential thing in practicing the way is to make the roots deep and the stem strong. Well, in Zen parlance, the roots refer to this basic practice, whether we're sitting or we're moving about, means to not cling to anything, to not abide in anything, not be stuck anywhere, not be caught up in attachment to objects, either physical objects or mental objects. When we're sitting, we call this zazen. Just holding the mind firm, steady on just this, whatever this is for any individual person, the breath, the koan, or just this, here, now. In Zen, we call this no mind. Not trafficking in thought. Make the roots deep and the stem strong. Be aware of where you really are 24 hours a day. That's a lifetime of practice. Be aware of where you really are 24 hours a day. In the Buddha's instructions on meditation, he says very famously, he says, one who is doing this practice, when she breathes, she knows she is breathing. When she walks, she knows she is walking. When he lifts, he knows he is lifting. In other words, awareness, self-awareness. This is not how most people go through their days. They're lost in thought. Most people don't have a clue what they're doing as they're doing it, because they're split, doing one thing with a mind somewhere else. It's an endless practice, this practice of meticulous attention and awareness. He goes on, you must be most attentive. When nothing at all sticks to your mind, it all merges harmoniously, without boundaries. The whole thing is empty and still, and there's no more doubt or hesitation in anything you do. This is called the fundamental matter appearing ready-made. As soon as you give rise to the slightest bit of dualistic perception or arbitrary understanding, and you want to take charge of this fundamental matter and act the master, then you immediately fall into the realm of the clusters of form, sensation, thought, choice, volition, and consciousness. That's six. Okay, these are the skandhas. Many translated in many different ways. These are the constituents of individual existence. But just to use five particular ones here: form, sensation, thought or conception, choice or volition, and consciousness. This is what we chant in the Prajnaparamita. First form, and then feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. This is what we call the self. It's composed of these five elements. Without all five of these elements, there's no self. For that matter, even when there are all five of these elements, there's no self. You are entrapped by seeing, hearing, feeling, and knowing, by gain and loss and right and wrong. You are half drunk and half sober and unable to clean all this up. Frankly speaking, you simply must manage to keep concentrating, even in the midst of clamor and tumult, acting as though there were not a single thing happening, penetrating all the way through from the heights to the depths. Another master who warned about this attachment to silence is Hakuin, the roughneck Hakuin, who spoke of the honey-sweet taste of what he called dead sitting and silent illumination, which is just another way of dividing the world and indulging in our preferences, that it be this and not that. Now, of course, the conditions for meditation, we want them to be relatively quiet and still. Why? Because it makes it easier for us. It's difficult to do it in clamor and tumult. But just if we can persevere in the clamor and tumult, the stick and other things, or in the city, with windows open in the summer and all the noise going on, as we sometimes have at Arnold Park, if we can persevere through that, then we develop a strength that one does not develop when one is attached to certain perfect conditions. In Sesshin, we follow the tradition of having a retreat center and a quiet, natural surroundings. But we must never lose sight of the danger of getting attached to those conditions. You must become perfectly complete, without any shapes or forms at all, without wasting effort, yet not inhibited from acting. Whether you speak or stay silent, whether you get up or lie down, it is never anyone else. It means no sense of other, self and other, no self-consciousness. If you become aware of getting at all stuck or blocked, this is all false thought at work. Make yourself completely untrammeled, like empty space, like a clear mirror on its stand, like the rising sun lighting up the sky. Moving or still, going or coming, it doesn't come from outside. Let go and make yourself independent and free, not being bound by things and not seeking to escape from things. From beginning to end, fuse everything into one whole. Where has there ever been any separate worldly phenomenon apart from the Buddha Dharma, or any separate Buddha Dharma apart from worldly phenomena? Here too, in Sesshin, we create conditions where people don't have to deal with any more of phenomena than we need to. That is, keeping our eyes down so we don't have to be processing the sights we see, maintaining silence so we don't have to deal with words so much. But ultimately, the whole practice is about living in the world of phenomena. Where else can we live but in the world of phenomena? That's the only world we have, is the world of phenomena. This is why the founder of Zen pointed directly to the human mind. This is why the Diamond Sutra taught the importance of human beings detaching from forms, And most importantly of all, the forms are thoughts. Those are forms, thought forms. Those are the ones we most of all have to detach from. To develop this essential insight, it is best to spend a long time going back into yourself and investigating with your whole being, so that you can arrive at the stage of the genuine experience of enlightenment. This is what it means to study with boundless, infinite, enlightened teachers everywhere in every moment. Strive sincerely for true faith and apply yourself diligently to your meditation work. This is the best course for you. And with that, we'll stop and recite the four vows.